we discussed something and I want to clarify it. So we were discussing about the stability of particles. And I told you how imposing a parity in a new sector gives this to a dark matter candidate. And as an example, I gave you why the proton stable, why the electron stable. So the way I explained the electron stability wasn't clear, so I'm going to do it again. So we were saying, OK, the electron wants to decay. And I was mentioning lepton number as a concern or an accidental symmetry of the standard model. And how it is conserved, then the electron cannot decay. And I think as you were saying, what is your name, by the way?
Ali.
Ali. OK. So as Ali was saying, well, so it could maybe decay into through a four fermion operator. Like it could do this, right? That doesn't violate electron-lepton number. But obviously, this violates charge conservation. So it cannot be. So then one thing I should have explained much better is that actually, charge conservation by itself is the only reason why the electron is stable. So let me explain something. Imagine that actually we allow for baryon violation and lepton number violation. And then you can imagine things like, I want to conserve electric charge. That's super important, so I'm going to conserve it. So how could the electron decay in the standard model? We could imagine we need to produce something that has electric charge minus one. So we could try to decay into a UD, for example, or U bar, D bar, I don't remember which one, right? But this guy violates baryon number, it violates lepton number, it doesn't violate charge, but it violates something very important. Two things. First, this guy, where is the mass of the electron? You remember, more or less? The mass of the electron?
0.5
MeV. And the masses of the light quarks, do you remember more or less?
Bound or unbound?
good question. Unbound. So it's about few GeVs. There is no, well, at low energies, there is no unbound quarks. But when they just track the values of the up and down quarks, they tend to have in a range of the few GeVs. So this is few GeVs, what am I saying? MeVs. Boy, more coffee. So this guy is below MeV. These guys are above MeV. So this violates energy and momentum conservation. But what else is violating this decay? Like, that is, like, this is the decay, but at the end it's an operator of.
So do they have any, they can have angular momentum.
Yeah, so we have an operator of three. Why? Because so we have three quarks, three fermions, the electron, the up, and the down. So we are saying that in our Lagrangian, or in our theory, there is a coupling of this kind. Why is this bad? This is important for supersymmetry. So you're used to see things like four fermion operators of this kind, right? That seems perfectly all right. Why an operator that contains three Dirac fermions is not a good thing to write down? It's because fermions transform under the Poincaré group. The Poincaré group includes the Lorentz transformation. Why is that? Well, so what is the Poincaré group? It's the group of isometries, SO31. Special orthogonal transformations where a signature of plus or minus of three of the components or minus or plus of the time component. Those are the isometries of space-time. So as it happens, these guys are isomorphic to a product of two SU2s. Have you ever seen isomorphic group symmetries, stuff like this? Okay, great. Essentially, you take the generators of SU3-1 and you can arrange them in two subsets that fulfill an SU2 and another SU2. So when you write a Dirac fermion as having the left and the right components, you can see that these Dirac fermions, these two components, transform differently until these two SU2s. So let me call this one left and this one right. Why do I want to call them left and right? Put this label. Because psi left is going to be a doublet under the first guy and a singlet under the second SU2. And psi right is going to be a singlet under the left, a doublet, and then the right. So when we look at Lorentz transformations of space-time, the fermions, the spinors, transform non-trivially. So this operator here has spinor indices. They are not contracted. So what's going to happen is, why is that bad, essentially? It's not Lorentz invariant, exactly. So this operator is not Lorentz invariant. So if the electron, imagine that as it happens that the quarks are lighter than the electron, still it could decay through this kind of vertex because that will violate Lorentz invariance. Yeah. All right? Okay. So I wanted to specify this because it gives me an excuse to introduce this notation here, and this is going to be interesting for supersymmetry. Okay, so the reason why the electron is stable is because it's the lightest charged particle in nature. That's it. Nothing to do with the lepton number. Even if lepton number was violated, still the electron wouldn't decay. Okay, so let's start with supersymmetry. I see supersymmetry as a tail of unification because supersymmetry unifies our understanding of the fermionic world, the matter world, and the world of interactions of bosons. It unifies is able to unify the coupling constants of the electroweak and strong sector. And it's also able to unify our understanding of visible matter and dark matter. So in supersymmetry, within the context of supersymmetry, we start unifying lots of things. So what is the key point of supersymmetry? So remember, that not all fields are created equal. And what I mean by that is that if you happen to be a particle of spin 1/2 and you want to stay at low energies, you can use called chiral symmetry to help you. There is a symmetry helping you. If you are a particle of spin 1 and you are a force carrier, you can then call your gauge symmetry to make sure that your mass is either 0 or of the scale of symmetry breaking. And if you are a particle of spin 0, So far, you don't know any reason why your mass should be down there. So scalars seem to lack a symmetry or a way of stabilizing their scales, their masses, their physics. So one obvious way of stabilizing scalars is if the scalar could, if you want, couple to either a Gauge boson or a Carroll in any, sorry, or a fermion in any way, maybe the protection of the Gauge boson will protect the scalar. Maybe the chiral symmetry of the fermion will protect the scalar. So that's precisely one proposal. You link the spin zero particle to spin one particles in something called Gauge Higgs unification. Gauge Higgs unification. This is one proposal for beyond the standard model. The idea of Gauge Higgs unification is that the Higgs is just the fifth component of a gauge field in extra dimensions. So the same symmetry that is protecting the gauge boson is also protecting the fifth component. So that's one idea. But supersymmetry, what it does is links the scalar to a fermion. That's supersymmetry. In the way it does it, is it puts in the same SUSY supersymmetric multiplet a fermion called Higgsino and the scalar Higgs. So the same chiral symmetry that is protecting the Higgsino is going to end up protecting corrections for the Higgs mass. So often when you read about supersymmetry, it looks like, wow, I start computing corrections for the Higgs mass, loop corrections, and there are some contributions that, as a miracle, cancel the first contribution. So there's a miraculous cancellation. There is no miracle in it. At the end of the day, it's just the fact that you are putting in the same multiplet a fermion and a scalar. So a protection for the Higgsino, the chiral symmetry of the Higgsino is actually also protecting, at the end of the day, the Higgs. Okay, any questions? All right. So that's, in a nutshell, how super... Yes, Ali.
Do they predict any mass
particles? Yes, we are going to go to that because SUSY is one of these tales that become more and more complicated as you realize of the different details. Any questions?
What do you mean by
yes, so the Higgsino, sorry, I should, maybe it's not clear. This is a fermion. This is spin one half. A particle, and we were discussing about naturalness, and you remember, for the case of the fermions, we know that all corrections for the fermion mass go renormalized multiplicatively, right? And they go as a log. Why? Because as I send the fermion mass to zero, I recover a bigger symmetry, chiral symmetry. That makes that if once I put the fermion mass to be, let's say, 100 GeVs, the fermion mass corrections, loop corrections, are not going to upset this relation. Right? So we are saying that fermions have a protection, this natural protection, this chiral symmetry, whereas scalars do not. What supersymmetry does is to link, in a way, scalars and fermions so that at the end of the day, once the fermion is protected, the scalar will be protected for the by the same token. We are going to see this in detail. But great. Please ask questions, because otherwise, I go and go and go. OK, that's the idea in a nutshell. Let's see how it works in practice. So coming back to this story, Does a scalar transform under the space-time symmetries? Brenda? No, it's a scalar. Doesn't have any spinorial index, doesn't have any space-time index. It doesn't transform under the Poincaré group. OK, so.
Well, I mean, the statement should be that it transforms trivially.
Yes, let me call this not transforming. But yes, it transforms trivially. Good. So, what supersymmetry is doing is a transformation. Opa, sorry. Let me call this the generator of transformations of supersymmetry that is going from a boson to a fermion. Actually, let me like this. And from the fermion to a boson. Or in other words, supersymmetry is linking a fermionic field to a bosonic field. The supersymmetric transformation is doing this. Is once you apply the transformation to a fermion, you get a boson. Once you apply the transformation to a boson, you get a fermion. And this is the way supersymmetry is linking the two. So it's linking something that has spin 1 halves to spin 0. OK. So as we say, the boson, the scalar, doesn't transform under Poincaré symmetry. The fermion does. So if we want this transformation to not violate Lorentz invariance on Poincaré symmetry, what do we need? What are the characteristics that we expect from this supersymmetric transformation?
It's unitary.
Hmm?
It's unitary.
Unitary, yes, so because it's a transformation. But let's say, you can think of this fermion as having a spinor index, right? Here. And this is a spinor index. So here I have a transformation on a guy with an index leads to a guy without index. So I need to do something here, right? What is it?
Fermionic.
You have to, it has to be fermionic. I have to contract these indices. And this guy has to have the same index here. So SUSY transformations are fermionic. And this is a big, big deal. It took a very long time for people to realize this. And actually, what it took is to try to evade a no-go theorem. So how did people come out with this transformation that has a fermionic index? So far, you are used to symmetries of space-time and also internal symmetries, like, for example, SU2 or parity or stuff like this. Those are bosonic symmetries. Why did people come out with a fermionic symmetry? They didn't know that that was going to help to the hierarchy problem. The reason why they came up with supersymmetry is the following. There was this guy, Coleman, and another guy, Mandula. And they came out with a no-go theorem. What they were trying to do is to extend the symmetries of space-time beyond what we know so far, beyond Poincaré. So they sat down, they thought, OK, so we describe everything with a quantum field theory. Theories of interest admit a matrix description. And the no-go theorem was to say that in a quantum field theory with an S-matrix description, there is no way of extending Poincaré symmetry. They didn't say that this way. Yes?
So, I mean, the way I understand it is that they were trying to see what could be the maximal symmetry of this matrix.
Yes, exactly. So they were trying to, what they knew is that the Lie algebra of of the quantum field theory of Fermat's matrix contain a Poincaré, the space-time symmetries, but it was a direct product of internal symmetries. And what they say is that to extend them, we would like to have some kind of non-trivial, like you were saying, non-trivial interaction between this internal and the Poincaré symmetries. That would be a way of extending it. And what they concluded is that that was impossible, but what they assumed was that the internal symmetries were bosonic.
So yes. My point is that this Lie algebra is the Lie algebra of the symmetry of the S matrix.
Yes.
Not space-time.
Yes, okay, yes. Right, so this is the symmetry of space-time,
right.
And the total S matrix contains the symmetries of space-time, direct product of the internal symmetry. Yes. So what they were trying to do is to extend the Poincaré symmetry, obtain a way of adding more internal symmetries, but that these internal symmetries were able to talk non-trivially with the Poincaré symmetry. That would be a way of extending the symmetries of this Poincaré symmetry. And their conclusion was, this is not possible. Obviously, when you write down a no-go theorem, and you call it a no-go theorem, it's calling for physicists to try to find a way of avoiding this, right? Finding a loophole for the no-go theorem. And it didn't take a long time, so let me write the names of the people who did it. I'm going to make a mistake, but okay. So some guys, Lopusansky, and I think Sonius, where did I write it? I think it was Sonius, but I'm very bad with names. So some people came out and found a way of avoiding the no-go theorem. They found a loophole. Obviously, there are many loopholes in this no-go theorem, starting from the assumption that you have a theory with an S matrix description. So do you know of theories, or do you study theories without an S matrix description, ever? You did, Tibram. You guys. Did you ever have a course on
no.
CFTs?
Oh, yeah, we don't have.
Conformal field theories do not have an S matrix description because there is no mass scale, there is no mass gap, there is no such as an in and out states. So there is a very simple way of avoiding this. But are CFTs interesting for particle physics? Okay. So their theorem was pretty solid until these guys came with this idea. Okay, so now we are going to extend. One of the assumptions is that the internal symmetry were bosonic. Or in other words, they were trying to find new generators or new internal symmetries that will commute in a non-trivial way with the Poincaré algebra, that will have a commutation relation. So what they did is to say, OK, so instead of commutation, we are going to start with an algebra that instead of being bosonic, is fermionic. And then what I expect is anti-commutation relations. So let me write them down. They say, this is my algebra. Okay. Alpha, beta are indices of SU2 left, and they go from 1 to 2. The dots is the same, but SU2 right. And again, they go from 1 to 2. They are fermionic generators. And where is the non-trivial interaction comes from? Well, they took, okay, so assume these anti-commutation relations. And now, if we write the anti-commutation between these two, this is going to be 2 sigma mu alpha beta mu. Where this is a generator of the Poincaré algebra. So those guys talk to the Poincaré algebra. Beautiful. So they realized that these guys, Q, in other words, Q alphas, had to be, in this case, among half, had to be essentially a fermion of SU2 left, transforming trivially under SU2 left, and the Q bars with the dot indices transform under the SU2 right. So they are transforming as fermions, as left and right-handed fermions. So they are fermionic. Okay. And because they are fermionic, then we can deduce some other things. For example, we can write down when I take my fermionic transformation and I commute it with, for example, the generator rotations on angular momentum in the Poincaré algebra, I get something non-trivial as well. It transforms as what you will expect from a spinor. Theta, Q, theta. On the other hand, these guys are transformed trivially with the generators of boost, for example, with the four momentum. This is zero.
Is that letter sigma or?
This is a sigma mu nu, and now it has a, and the index is alpha beta. Sigma mu nu is the commutator of sigma mu, sigma nu. So every sigma, so sigma mu nu is proportional to a commutator of sigma mu, sigma nu. And the alpha beta index is the alpha and the beta index you can attach to this guy. Okay. So this is just telling you that this guy transforms as a spinor. This is telling you that this guy is a translationally invariant. So it commutes with the generators of translation. Okay, cool. What else can we do? Okay.
So question.
Yes, good.
Sigma mu up there has two spinor indices?
Yes. Ah, because this is a... Did I say something stupid? Yes, this is a 2x2 matrix, right?
Yeah.
And this alpha and beta are in the subset of 1 and 2, right? So sigma mu contains two indices, so probably here I say something silly, right? So sigma mu is a commutator, so that means that this guy has to have one of the indices contracted. Thank you. I think in the first homework you did some of this. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
Do we use something to raise the spinor index here?
Yes, you need to use this index, alpha, beta. So I'm writing formally what are the commutation and anti-commutation relations. In this course, we are not going to make use of this mathematical background. We are going to go directly into the phenomenology of supersymmetry, but I wanted to show you how, in practice, they wrote down or they evaded the Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem. That was a great idea. It was fantastic. Because not only they showed that this was a way of avoiding the Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem, they showed something else. They showed that this is the maximal extension of the Poincaré symmetry. With an S matrix description. Why is this important? It means that if there is supersymmetry out there, and a large Hadron collider discovers supersymmetry, or supersymmetric particles, will be great, not only because we discovered new particles, but because their presence will mean that nature has realized maximally the symmetries of the Poincaré, or the Poincaré symmetry. Yes?
So if are they trying to say that the S-mate, that a theory with, say, n equals to 2 supersymmetry will not have an S-matrix?
No, they say any kind of, yes, I should be very picky with that. Here, I'm not writing the indices of these guys. So I'm not telling you how many of these generators Q alpha we have.
Right.
So in n equals 1, you will have 1, but then you can add an index.
Right.
And then you can write different versions of supersymmetry. So that's important, yes. So supersymmetry, this is the idea. Those are the commutation relations and anti-commutation. But SUSY can come in several versions. You can have 1 SUSY, 2 SUSYs, 4 SUSYs, 8 SUSYs, and I think that's it, right? 16 maybe. Okay, so they can come, you can have more than one generator, fermionic generator. And what we are going to do in this course is talk about n equals 1 supersymmetry, but there is no reason why it should be just n equals 1. But the question is that supersymmetry as a symmetry, as an extension of the Poincaré symmetry, is the maximal extension. So what is exciting about finding supersymmetry is because we will have discovered not only the symmetry, a new symmetry, a new principle, but also this will be the maximal extension. I think it's exciting. Okay. Yes.
Was the maximal symmetry Poincarian, internal boson and internal fermion?
Yes. So what they are saying is that you can, your maximum symmetry will be a Lie algebra with a Poincaré of a space-time, internal bosonic symmetries, and non-trivial internal fermionic symmetries, supersymmetry. And this is the way it can work, and this is the only way it can work. All right, so that was the motivation in 79. And what people realized afterwards is that actually supersymmetry is not only beautiful and amazing and mathematical and a way of maybe quantizing gravity and all this, but also supersymmetry tends to solve, tends to unify lots of aspects in particle physics. So that's what we are going to discuss now. So, very nice. Let's move on into more phenomenological aspects of supersymmetry. So I told you, supersymmetry helps on stabilizing a scalar by putting the scalar and the fermion in the same supermultiplet. So let's talk about this. These guys, the Higgsino and the Higgs in supersymmetry, are part of a multiplet. It's called supermultiplet. That's why for supersymmetry. But it's a specific kind. It's called Cara supermultiplet. So let's describe this Cara supermultiplet. Essentially, we want a theory. Of fermions and bosons are supersymmetric. So I think the first people to write down this kind of supermultiplet and possible interactions was Wes and Vess and Zumino. And that's why this is called the Wes-Zumino model. Okay, so what they wrote down is, I'm going to write a Lagrangian that contains a scalar, for the moment, just non-interacting scalar and a fermion. Okay. So let's say the scalar is a complex scalar. How many degrees of freedom is a complex scalar?
Two.
Very good. What's your name?
Jacob.
I had to start learning. So that's 2 degrees of freedom. Since I want to write down a theory that matches degrees of freedom as well, I want to write a theory that in the same multiple puts the same number of degrees of freedom that are bosonic and fermionic, I need to write down a fermion that has 2 degrees of freedom. And from your homework on Monday, past Monday, what kind of fermion has 2 degrees of freedom? Or in other words, how many degrees of freedom has a normal Dirac fermion?
Four.
So in which ways you can reduce the from 4 degrees of freedom to 2 degrees of freedom?
Majorana.
Majorana, yes. So if the fermion is Majorana, I can match a complex scalar with a fermion. It will have 2 degrees of freedom. So the Westumino model is a model of a complex scalar and a Majorana fermion. And it's a good starting point of learning about supersymmetric transformations.
Sorry. Question?
Yes.
So Majorana fermion would not transform into a complex scalar.
Sorry.
Would it, Majorana fermion would only have problem transforming between a real fermion and a complex? So, you know, chiral supermodule should probably have a chiral fermion.
You mean?
What I'm saying is that another way of having 2 degrees of freedom
yes.
is not to have a Majorana fermion, but to have a Weyl fermion.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
But in this Weyl fermion, so let's say I write a Weyl fermion. I don't know how you, let's say Weyl, right? And I want to write this Weyl fermion as a Dirac fermion. The way I do this, the trick, is to write your Weyl fermion as a Dirac fermion where this guy, you can also project it out, but you can just make it redundant. That's a Majorana fermion, or so that's the way to write a Weyl fermion inside a Dirac fermion. Another way is to take a Dirac fermion, and as you're saying, project out the lower component. You can do that too.
Right, the middle one, which is the Dirac fermion, that's a Majorana fermion. Really.
Yes, exactly. So the way I write a 2-component fermion into a 4-component fermion is either projecting out the lower component or upper component, or writing it as a Majorana fermion. So this becomes Majorana.
Okay.
All right.
But if we were in 2-component notation, it would be the same if it's Weyl or Majorana from the 4-component.
Yes, exactly. So you just have to decide what you want to do. If you want to write things in terms of Dirac 4-component notation, just make sure that you provide these constraints for Majorana. Or you always write your Dirac guy, but with a projector in front. Anything but to reduce from 4 to 2 degrees of freedom. OK. So I think the particle physics courses, you took them using the Weyl component fermion all the time, right? But the rest of the time, when you look at SUSY literature, most of the time they are using Dirac notation. So it's good to think in terms of Dirac notation. So where is this chiral supermultiplet of my Lagrangian is going to contain 2 free fields. One of them, this complex scalar, non-interacting just derivatives, and then this guy, sigma mu, partial mu, where this guy is a Weyl fermion. Oops, sorry. Okay. So we want to take this Lagrangian, apply a supersymmetric transformation to the Lagrangian, and find out under what circumstances this leads to zero, up to total derivatives, obviously. So we want to find a form of the supersymmetric transformations that leave this free scalar and free fermion theory invariant. So what we were saying is that the SUSY transformations under the of the scalar should lead to the fermion. And the SUSY transformation of the fermion should lead to the scalar. That's roughly speaking, because as we were mentioning, this guy has no spinor index, this does. So we had to match the end distance. All right. So let's go there and do that. So now I assume this seems to be the simplest starting point. We are going to see how the supersymmetric transformations act on the scalars. And as I say, this guy has an index. Yes?
What about the equations of motion?
Yes, good. Okay, so, yes. So this is just a free scalar and free fermion theory. The equations of motion are kind of trivial. Yes, but when we get to interactions, that will become important. Yes. So let's try to match. The only way to match the spinor index is by saying that our parameter in the supersymmetric transformation is fermionic. That's kind of obvious. So epsilon alpha is a spinor and is the parameter we use for SUSY transformations. But it's a funny spinor. Why is that? Because what are the dimensions of a scalar? Yes, you. What is the mass dimension of a scalar field? Or whoever wants to answer.
And how many dimensions?
Four dimensions. In the
one.
Far, yes, one. Good. Where are the dimensions in? The mass dimensions of a fermion in four dimensions.
Three halves.
So where are the mass dimensions of these guys? Minus one half. So it's kind of a weird dimension. This is, so this spinor SUSY transformation, for the moment, we are saying that this transformation is not a function of space-time. We are saying that this SUSY transformation is global, right? We are only considering global SUSY. Later on, we are going to consider gauge SUSY. And from supersymmetry, once we gauge this guy, so we assume that this transformation is a function of space-time, we are going to go from supersymmetry to supergravity, or super. So in the context of supersymmetry, we are able to describe gravity as a supersymmetric theory. It has to, because as soon as we describe this fermionic guy as being a function of space-time, you have to supersymmetrize supergravity as well, gravitational interaction. So these mass dimensions of this parameter are going to become important if when we deal with supergravity, or the kind of interactions of supergravity. Okay, so that's an easy way of describing the supersymmetric transformations for a scalar. So let's do the same for a fermion. So now transformation of the scalar is epsilon phi. Suppressing indices, transformation of the other guy, the complex scalar is going to be epsilon dagger psi dagger, again suppressing indices. So from the scalar part of my Lagrangian, the supersymmetric variation is going to contain minus epsilon d mu, d mu phi plus Hermitian conjugate. So I'm going to vary both derivatives, both for these guys. With each of them, I'm going to get an epsilon or an epsilon dagger. And the idea is that we want to do the same to the fermionic part of the Lagrangian in a way that it ends up canceling this contribution. So we want to obtain that the variation of the fermionic part is minus the variation of the bosonic part plus derivative, total derivative. Let's say up to total derivatives. So using that, we are going to deduce what is the transformation, supersymmetric transformation for the Fermi. Yes?
In the variation of phi plus conjugate, why don't you have phi dagger and then epsilon dagger?
Yes, so this is here. This term you are talking about is here. The Hermitian conjugate. So you can start the variation of this part of the Lagrangian will be the variation of this multiplied by that plus the variation of that multiplied by just the derivative.
But there's a definition of the variation on the top.
I think she means that you do the transpose as well since it's a scalar.
No, so this comes
not
from.
This one,
no, it's top.
Yes, here?
Yes.
Okay. And so is that all right?
Yes.
Yes, and this is the part that is confusing?
Yeah, why don't you have the opposite?
Ah, well, sorry. Yeah, because I am suppressing the indexes. So if I write them explicitly, it doesn't matter in which order I do it. But yeah, indeed, you should. Yes. If I'm suppressing, I should do this. Very good. Yes. Okay.
Couldn't you see it as you did first the complex conjugate, and then since it was a scalar, you can transpose it?
Yes.
And then it would be the first one.
So in this case, where I'm keeping this guy and just transforming the scalar, and then I'm getting
where you were before.
Yes, here.
Yes.
Yes. What is the?
Shouldn't it be the first one? If you don't suppress.
So. This guy is a two-vector. This guy is a two-vector. I just know that I need to contract each other. So one should be the transpose of the other. Like essentially, I had to do a multiplication like this. Doesn't matter if I do epsilon 1 dagger, epsilon 2 dagger, psi 1 dagger, psi, sorry, 1, 2 dagger. The result is the same as if I decide to put this guy like this and this guy like this, obviously. Right? So it doesn't matter if I write it epsilon dagger, psi dagger, or the contrary. At the end, it's a scalar product. It doesn't matter in which order I do it.
But this scalar product, in the because you're contracting with the epsilon, it doesn't mean next one with zero.
Well, it's just going to be this guy, plus this guy, and this guy. And so it is the same as if I decide to do.
So, yeah, but I mean that.
No, I think Aitor is saying that here you wrote the epsilon with the index upstairs.
Yes.
And
so it means that
if you copy the 1 and 2 on epsilon should probably be upstairs.
And so you're saying that
should
this should be
up.
Like this,
yeah.
And to lower the index, I should use the epsilon.
Right.
Thank you. Okay, so let's not get lost in this detailed discussion. The question is that this is the variation for the scalar part. We want to match it with the fermionic part. And doing that up to total derivatives, we are going to obtain the explicit expression for this, for the supersymmetric variation of the fermion. No. So now I take the fermionic part. So this is going to be minus I for a variation I'm doing in the wild fermion decker, sigma mu, and then derivative mu of psi minus I psi dagger sigma mu partial mu of the variation of this guy. And you see, it is important that we are considering global supersymmetry so that the parameter does not depend on space-time coordinates. So as it happens, you can sit down and think in which ways I could write down and contract the spinorial indices as to cancel this contribution there. But the answer is this one. So let me write explicitly the indices, because sigma mu, epsilon, dagger, alpha, plus mu of phi. This will make this kind of transformation in the fermionic sector will cancel the scalar transformation up to total derivatives. So this object here, so this guy is a 2x2 matrix. This is a vector of two components. And you're just making sure that after this, this is the index that is kept free. And it matches the spinorial index here. OK. So is that the end of it? Is that the Westumino model for a free scalar and a free fermion? No, it isn't, because there is a little subtlety here. So we want this supersymmetric theory, or these supersymmetric transformations, to hold at the quantum level. And what it means is that we want to be able to describe fields that are off-shell. So when we were discussing about how a complex scalar has 2 degrees of freedom and a fermion, a wild fermion has 2 degrees of freedom, that was an on-shell statement. Once you use the equations of motion, you get that your wild fermion has 2 degrees of freedom. Actually, before you use your equations of motion, so off shell, your wild fermion has 4 degrees of freedom. So you want to use or to make use of supersymmetry at the quantum level, you have to fix this issue of matching of bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. So the way to go is you take your Lagrangian for the fermion and for the scalar.
Question?
Yes.
How do you see the transform degrees of freedom?
So that comes back to the moment where you did quantum field theory the first time. You write the Dirac equation. Before you use the equations of motion, you have 4 degrees of freedom for an electron. And once you use the equations of motion, you get rid of 2 of those degrees of freedom. Did they see that? I guess so. If you don't, I mean, it's no big deal. This I don't have a good memory. I always had to go back and look at it. So look at it. So the question is that when you are considering, let's see, here a virtual particle in a loop, this guy has more degrees of freedom than having a fermion in the final state. So a final, if you write here a Weyl fermion, it will have 2 degrees of freedom. Here it will have 4. It's only when you are writing down the equations of motion, you are imposing the equations of motion, that you reduce the number of degrees of freedom. And this is only possible for asymptotic states, for states that are final, that are produced on shell. Whereas this guy is produced off shell, it's a virtual particle, it has a higher number of degrees of freedom. Yes?
But do you mean Weyl or the Majorana?
Here I mean Weyl. Actually, you have a Dirac, you have 4, and then off shell you get 8. So even at the level of a Weyl fermion, 9 is 2 degrees of freedom. Once we want to put it out or put it off shell, then we start getting into trouble so that we are missing 2 bosonic degrees of freedom. So the way of solving this, of extending the validity of supersymmetry at the quantum level, is using auxiliary fields. So I'm going to add fields that are non-propagating. Let's call this guy F. It's a scalar field. It's a complex scalar, so there is an F star. It's 2 degrees of freedom that we add to the theory of shell. Just to make sure that even when we are, I'm describing fermions of shell, I still get the matching degrees of freedom. It sounds convoluted, but essentially what it's doing is it's enlarging the structure of the Susi transformations, adding a new guy. But this guy is just a trick. It's a guy whose equations of motion of F is just to set F to 0. So that on shell, this guy doesn't exist. But it doesn't propagate, it's nothing. It's just something I write formally in my Lagrangian just to make sure that my supersymmetric transformations are still valid off shell. I know, it's kind of weird, but it's a very interesting trick. So you take your Lagrangian, and because you want to use it at the quantum level, you add a Lagrangian containing the F. And what is the F Lagrangian? It's something as simple as saying F, F dagger. That's my Lagrangian for the F. So what are the equations of motion for F? When I derive respect to F dagger, F star, or respect to F, I get this equation of motion. It's setting the field actually to 0. Sounds silly that you are just adding an extra field. It's non-propagating, it does nothing. What I mean by non-propagating is that the only term that relates the F contains no derivatives. This guy doesn't have a propagator. And on top of that, you also, it doesn't have any kind of interaction because F star is just setting the F to 0 on shell. So this Lagrangian on shell is the same as the Lagrangian we wrote before. Part of shell is just matching the number of degrees of freedom that we need to describe off shell fermions. This question of auxiliary fields is kind of strange at the beginning. It looks like a trick, but actually we are going to see in a couple of days that supersymmetry cannot be a symmetry of nature. Supersymmetry must be broken. And one way we break supersymmetry is making use of these auxiliary fields. So this guy is going to become important, although it looks like just a fix, a trick that you add to your theory. It has no effect for the physics, but it has this subtle effect of matching degrees of freedom. Okay. So it's a non-propagating auxiliary field. It seems to do nothing, so it looks kind of weird. Okay. So that's for the chiral supermultiplet. So the chiral supermultiplet in supersymmetry. Is described by a complex scalar, a wild fermion, a non-propagating complex scalar degree of freedom. In the case of the Higgs, this is the Higgs, this is the Higgs, you know, and this is this auxiliary field. We still call it F. Okay, cool. So finally, we put together a scalar and a fermion. And what we are going to see is that the protection for the fermion is going to also end up protecting the scalar. So the mass of the fermion and of the scalar tend to be of the same order. So now we would like to add, to use this theory with regular gauge interactions. Now we are talking about a spin one field, and we would like to come out with the field in the supersymmetric field. So we know spin one fields are bosons. It needs to go to a fermion. What kind of fermion? So this the gauge fields are unified in supersymmetry into gauge or vector supermultiplets. The story is very similar. You take your gauge boson, let's say your gluon, so it has an index in the adjoint. Then the way you complement this in supersymmetry is to add a fermion, let's call it lambda, with the same adjoint index. So this is in the adjoint of wherever the gauge field, for example, is UN. And the same story as in the chiral supermultiplet. When I describe this theory, this guy, by the way, is a Majorana fermion as well. So when I try to write the supersymmetric transformations of shell, I realize that I need extra degrees of freedom. And those are a scalar called D-term with also an adjoint. So this is called D-term. Whereas in the scale of the, in the case of the chiral supermultiplet, this is an F term. Okay. So supersymmetry predicts that for each interaction, so the standard, each interaction of the standard model, I'm going to have a Majorana fermion, one Majorana fermion per in adjoint index. So what supersymmetry is predicting is that we are going to find a bunch of Majorana fermions. So for example, if this is the gluon, we are going to see tomorrow that this guy will be called a gluino. And a gluino is a fermionic partner of the gluon. So tomorrow we will continue with this. And we will move into the simplest description of supersymmetry, which is the minimal supersymmetric standard model. This is the theory that most experimentalists are looking for at the Large Hadron Collider, the MSSM, the minimal supersymmetric standard model. You have any questions? As I said, my office is over there. You can always ask questions after class.